Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hello and welcome to the Irish Examiner podcast series on the Civil War. This year, 2022, of course, is the centenary of the Irish Civil War, which brought to an end a turbulent near decade of conflict that started with Easter 1916 and culminated in the birth of the state and the dispute over the Anglo-Irish Treaty signed in December 1921. In this series, we're examining various aspects of the war, which was characterised as pitting brother against brother and which unfortunately at times descended into a form of depravity with all sorts of atrocities that left a bitter legacy. Today we're talking about a giant of the times, the man described far and wide as the lost leader, Michael Collins. At the time of his death in Ballinabloch in West Cork on August 22, 1922, Collins was, I would suggest, far and away the most dominant figure on the Free State side of the Civil War. He was head of the Provisional Government and Commander-in-Chief of the Army, a breadth of responsibility that now seems perhaps unwise. Anyway, his death changed practically everything in the conflict, and we can only speculate as to whether the Civil War would have plumbed the depths it did if he had lived. But what of his life and his actual legacy? I'm delighted to be joined today to discuss the big fella with UCC lecturer and historian Gabriel Doherty. Gabriel, you're very welcome.
Thank you very much.
Gabriel, just to run through very quickly, and it's very thing a lot of time, but very quickly, the first chunk of Collins' backstory. Born outside Clonakilty, I think he was a late addition to his family. He grew up there, immigrated to London, where he worked in the post office, and he got involved in the IRB. He came home for the 1916 Rising and served as Plunkett said to comp in the GPO. He was detained in England and Wales and Frognock mainly in the aftermath. And then he returned to Ireland December 16, full of ideas about how to take on the British. So far, so...
That's about it.
Grand. Okay, Gabriel, so the thing then is, when and where did his potential as a leader and quite obviously a figure of high intelligence become obvious to those around him? Because we're talking now, the man was still in his late 20s just at that stage.
I mean, I suppose in the build-up to the 1916 Rising, he wasn't in Ireland long before being made aide-de-camp to one of the signatories. So that in itself was testimony to his ability and the judgment of those signatories as to the fact that he was very, very capable. When he was interned in Frongoch, he became one of the camp leaders. And again, he demonstrates all the qualities needed for a leader. But to me, I think that the point at which he starts to make a really concrete contribution to the independence struggle and the point at which his administrative abilities, which are so important, really came to the fore, was his time when he was in charge, in effect, of the finances. He was secretary to the Prisoner Dependence Fund. And it's in that guise in 1917 where he has to go around the country, meet all the families, where some of those prisoners are still, the family members are still in prison. He has to make judgments as to their need and so on and so forth. But much more importantly, he can form an impression of the strength, the support network that was in place at individual levels and in locales, as it were, for the prisoners and for the struggle that they were supporting. He was noted even at that time for his scrupulous conduct when it came to finances, to make sure that no money was siphoned off for personal benefit. And just the probity of his conduct, the energy he displayed in making sure that the money went to the right people. And his just general demeanour marked him out at that point as somebody who was going to go far.
He Yeah, and we're talking, like as I said, December 16, so you've, okay, it's another, the guts of 3 years really before the War of Independence starts. But he's not somebody who's been around a long time. Like, he was in London prior to that.
He was,
and
yeah.
Yet, and I suppose that thing with the prisoner funds was a great way of making contacts apart from assessing everything else.
Absolutely, and I suppose his background in the post office, and he'd branched out a little bit even when he was London into some of those sort of broader aspects of finance. He'd been associated with stockbroking firms. And of course, money drives revolutions, maybe the root of all evil, but you try and organise a revolution without it. So somebody who knew how to both raise money to make sure that those funds weren't going to be detected by the British and to make sure that the money raised was going to go to the right ends. I mean, that was very, very important.
And then following the election, it was December 18,
yep.
you have the provisional government set up. Was he an obvious choice?
Well, you have the Dáil Cabinet.
In
December 1918. So he, even though, of course, it takes some time after the election for the full Dáil arrangements to be put in place, because you still have people like De Valera in prison. But of course, one of the first things that Collins does is to get De Valera out of prison and as a jailbreak.
That was in Lincoln. Was
Lincoln Jail in England, yeah. So he, once everybody is in situ, his main role or his Dáil function was that of Minister for Finance. And of course, that meant that he had all the levers of power, that anybody who wanted to spend anything had to go through him. So it gave him an input into all government departments, and to a certain extent, it allows him to use his judgment as to where the money should go. Simultaneously with that, he's also officially Director of Intelligence for the Irish Volunteers, and of course, this gives him an insight into many different things, the intelligence gathering capability of collectively and individually of the volunteers, and also the state of play within the British administration, both political and military. But beyond those nominal roles, which were more than nominal, I mean, they were very, very real, his drive in his industry, in effect, marks him out as a figure of rare abilities within both the both the civil and the political. So I'd say that sense of having a foot in both camps, an individual who, by virtue of his pedigree and his upbringing, was seen to be a reliable Fenian, and somebody who was himself very, very high up by this stage in the IRB. Thomas Ashe, the former head of the IRB, of course, having died on hunger strike in 1917, gives him a position of tremendous strength, especially because De Valera, who in 1917 technically had taken over the leadership of both Sinn Féin and the Volunteers, was for the guts of 18 months or so in the United States.
How important or central or controversial was Collins' role in the IRB, because it was that secret society within the wider Republican movement?
It was very controversial. The whole idea behind creating Dáil Éireann was that there was no longer any need for these type of underground organisations. Indeed, some people like De Valera and Cathal Brewer had argued that once the Volunteers were founded and once Sinn Féin had moved in, as it were, a Republican direction by changing its constitution, even before the election of 1918 and the creation of the Dáil, or the first sitting of the Dáil on the 21st of January 1919, the IRB had run its course. And they argued that it created, as it were, a dangerous duality, because the leadership of the IRB regarded itself as, in effect, the de facto government of the Republic in being. But when you create the Dáil and the Dáil administration, the Dáil executive, which, of course, is composed of individuals, some of whom have an IRB background, some of whom don't.
So was Collins head of the IRB?
He's basically head of the IRB.
Really, what you're just scenario whereby you had this, the Dáil set up in what was still effectively under the Empire, so
yes.
it was unofficial in that respect, which was an unofficial government, if you want to put it that way.
Yeah.
But even within that,
yes,
you're again a secret society, effectively, of IRB, who saw themselves as being the real leaders.
Exactly. And again, that creates tremendous problems. It certainly creates a lot of problems latterly during the Civil War, especially when the IRB, in effect, as a result of Collins' backing, backs the treaty, and many members of the IRB were opposed to that. So it leads to splits within the IRB, as well as, of course, splits within Sinn Féin, the Volunteers, the Dáil and the like.
And just before I go back, you mentioned the IRB, just to finish the IRB, that split as a result of the treaty, I mean, one would have thought that in general terms, the IRB would possibly be more militant than the average volunteer. So it would be very reasonable to surmise that that was entirely down to Colin's persona that so many of them went with it.
I think there's no doubt. And of course, the same is true with regard to many volunteers and members of and TDs, yeah, and Sinn Féin. I mean, remember, the IRB is in effect the Fenian movement, the linear descendant of the original Fenians back in the 1850s and the 1860s. So it has tremendous kudos, tremendous prestige. It hadn't done a great deal for a number of years until Tom Clark, in particular, G's it up prior to the 1916 rising. And then Collins, in effect, takes over the mantle.
OK, and we're back to what War of Independence starts. This is going parallel to Collins performing his function as Minister for Finance. Quite obviously, there's huge overlap there. He was described subsequently, I think, in the Donald and Mays controversy as the man who won the war. Was he the leader of the War of Independence, de facto?
Yeah. Certainly, I mean, that quote came from Arthur Griffith,
yeah,
and the general perception was that he was the single most important figure within the volunteers. I don't think Griffith, in making that comment, meant to imply that nobody else did anything, obviously. Certainly, Cahill Brewer, who was Minister for Defence, took that compliment very personally. He felt it was directed towards him, because technically, under the way that the door saw itself, the army was supposed to be subordinate to the door. During the course of the conflict, swore an oath of allegiance to the Doyle. I remember also, of course, that the Chief of Staff of the Volunteers is Richard Mulcahy, somebody who didn't have a particularly high profile at this time, but who, of course, subsequently went on to have a long political career with Cumann na Gael and Fine Gael.
Whose daughter, Elizabeth, is still alive at the age of 101.
Absolutely. And I mean, Mulcahy was regarded as one of the extreme militants at this point. Interestingly, during the treaty debates, Cahill Brewer, in effect, singles out Richard Mulcahy on the other side and saying, basically, he's the one man for whom I have the utmost respect on the other side, which is, of course, a little ironic when one considers that Mulcahy was especially associated with the policy of execution, and his name is still real mud amongst those who subscribe to
that. And the nature of the war, Gabriel, like, okay, Director of Intelligence, in any scenario, that would be extremely important. But am I correct that a large extent, particularly I'd say in Munster, the actual operations, those operations that were taken against the British Army, ambushes, whatever, that kind of thing, were organised locally, and therefore, would that in turn have elevated further the role of Director of Intelligence over the national organisation?
I agree with the first part, but not necessarily the second part. I mean, one should remember that there are a number of outstanding figures operating here in Cork, and obviously in the intelligence department, Flory O'Donoghue, who was the intelligence officer, the leading intelligence officer for Cork No. 1 Brigade, and he, of course, had a direct line into Victoria Barracks because his future wife, Josephine, was a secretary there. As far as Collins' role, it's more at the national level. And, of course, remember that in his bailiwick, as it were, you have both the Dublin Metropolitan Police with its G Division, which is the political segment. You have the headquarters of the RIC and its special branch, and that has its reach nationally. And you also have the headquarters of the Army in Park Gate. So he was able to obtain a level of intelligence that perhaps was beyond and at a higher level than that which was directly relevant to the Cork No. 1, 2 or 3 brigades. There's no great evidence of any great tension between the national and the local level. Collins passed on, as were relevant information to them. And to the extent to which information gathered locally here in Cork could have a national bearing, and bearing in mind the difficulty of carrying documents and the like.
I kind of meant more that because the actual physical element of it, the attacks and all, were organised locally, therefore at a national level that wasn't as central as it might otherwise have been, and therefore
I take your point in that sense that as it were, at the ground level operations, these are very much the decisions of brigade commanders and then local commanders further down the chain of command. At the same time, even such a thing as, for example, weapons purchases, which was intended to be a very significant part of Collins' role as Minister for Finance, to sanction those, to the extent to which this was possible, and of course it was always difficult to arrange gun running, given that the British had control of the coasts, Collins sought to use his knowledge of the active units and in effect to reward them with resources such as those. So, I mean, yes, any guerrilla struggle, any really successful guerrilla struggle really has to be bottom up. And Collins, to his credit, never really sought to stop the local commanders, especially people like Florio Donoghue, from using their local knowledge to help the direction of operations. But again, the high level of intelligence, especially directed towards him, because, of course, he became very rapidly the British enemy number one, meant that he was always one step ahead of the opposition.
Now, one of the other things, again, when things became bitter after the treaty that was hurled at him, some suggested that he had never physically taken part in the War of Independence. Of course, apart from anything else, that completely ignores the fact that he had such a price on his head that if the man was caught, he'd have been tortured and subjected to a horrible debt, irrespective of what he did. But did he engage in any operations that we know
of? That's my knowledge, but if you have a general doing a private job in a war, then the general isn't doing his job.
Exactly.
I mean, it's as simple as that. There's what benefit would it have been to the Republican movement if they had one of their outstanding individuals getting themselves killed in a gun battle? The idea that Collins somehow had eluded danger, again, have a look at his role in prison breaks, where he personally is present and in De Valera's case, is the person who breaks the key in the lock that De Valera ultimately rescues. And of course, remember, he'd also been front and centre in 1916. He'd been in the GPO. He'd been part. He'd faced fire and fury during that point. So the idea that somehow, in terms of his personal courage or his integrity, that it was lacking. You try walking and cycling around Dublin when there's a price on your head for 2.5 years. But, I mean, he made the contribution. The best contribution to the volunteer movement by not getting involved in operations, but by directing them.
Okay, and then, as we know, there's the truce, there's negotiations, and suddenly he's the one who's sent to London. Dev maintains he's better off staying there, and we could go on forever talking about that controversy.
Yeah.
However, when he was in those negotiations, Gabriel, did his knowledge of the state of armoury and the state of preparedness among the volunteers feed at all into swaying him towards realising, you know, if we have to go back to war, it's the very, very last option?
I doubt it. My own view is that he took the position after weeks and months of talking face to face with Lloyd George, with Churchill, with Birkenhead and the like, that the British had gone as far as they could go in terms of the concessions. He and everybody else realised that simply getting a republic with no ties to Britain was not on the cards. And De Valera recognised that also, which is the reason why he comes up with the external association formula. He knows as well as everybody else that, of course, it wasn't an easy thing for the British to go back to war because the demands of an Irish campaign had been so great before then that it had led to the British having to strip units that would otherwise have gone to parts of the empire. It led to the idea that some reservists might have to be called up. So Collins knew that the British threatening war, that it may be true or it may not be true. But he recognised, I think in the final analysis, his main reason for going to war is not ultimately the threat of going back to war. It's more that if you do go back to war, you're not going to beat the British. I mean, you're not going to be able to have a conventional victory a la the Allies
you're
over Germany.
You're going to be back here in 6 months or
exactly,
a year.
And you're going to have exactly the same decisions to make, exactly the same compromises, as it were, to consider. So better make the call now rather than inflict further damage on both countries, as it were, and to lose more capable individuals whose services you would need whenever you got that independence.
The pointlessness of it, in that respect.
Of a renewed conflict.
Yeah. There is, of course, on the actual night they signed, the famous comment, I've just signed my actual debt warrant. That, apart from being prophetic, he obviously knew, even in the act of signing and everything, somewhere he sensed that there was going to be violent conflict of some sort.
I mean, remember that just before the day or two leading up to the signing, the delegates had been back in Dublin and they'd been able to get a flavour of opinion. And people like Cathal Brewer and Austin Stack have made it abundantly clear that the text as they had it at the previous weekend, which was slightly different, but not hugely different from the ultimate text that's finally signed, that they weren't going to accept it. And of course, given what had happened over the previous 5 years at that point, since 1916, and certainly since 1919, he must have known, given that he'd been so closely involved in the violent campaign, that there was a danger that this would rebound on him. Birkenhead, who had been the man who'd said that he'd signed his political death warrant, as it turns out, that wasn't really the case. Birkenhead, who was regarded almost as sort of on the extreme wing of the Unionist cause, he'd been heavily involved in the Home Rule campaign. Galloper Smith, as he'd been called. The British cabinet are able to get the treaty through the Westminster with very little difficulty. There was a small revolt from the extreme diehard wing of the Conservative Party, who had been viewed as being Birkenhead's natural constituency. But he continues to have a political career. What does for him ultimately is his alcoholism. So just because the two of them said that they had sort of death warrants didn't necessarily mean that they were that prescient.
Yeah. He comes back, there's the obvious split. And one impression I get, and you can tell me whether I'm totally off the mark here, spiritually, if you want to put it that way, or culturally, temperamentally, would he have been closer to those who ended up on the other side of the split, those who were on the anti-side?
Well, I mean, what I would say is I think that they were all pretty close to each other. And there are some people who go anti-treaty who might have thought would have gone pro-treaty, and vice versa. And some of the reasons and rationales given for the taking of one position or another didn't necessarily stand up hugely to scrutiny 100 years later, when we don't have to, as we're, consider the consequences of taking those positions. What I would say is that Collins was viewed as the ultimate hard man, which is one of the reasons why, of course, the British...
By his own crowd.
By the British, one of the reasons why the British were keen to have him involved. And it's, one of the reasons why I think De Valera is keen to have him there, because I don't think De Valera thought that he would cave into British pressure. And I'm not sure that even the term caving in is perhaps the best way of expressing it. But yes, I mean, given his background, I mean, he comes from the heart of Feeney and West Cork. I mean, his parents are buried next to, I think, Donovan Ross's parents, or his grandparents are. He's from the heart of Fenian territory. He's absolutely immersed in Fenian territory, Fenian activities, if you like, in the IRB in London, and had been ever since. So the fact that he took the treaty, I think, did the treaty side, came as a big surprise to many. Whether it was a welcome surprise or an unwelcome surprise was another thing. But yes, I think that he was close to many on the anti-treaty side. But of course, the same was true for practically everybody who took both sides. Yeah. I mean, after all, they had been fighting a common enemy. Yeah. Many of them had been out in 1916, had been in Frongoch, had been on the run together for most of 1919 to 1921. And of course, that sense of a common bond exacerbates all the feelings that arise when this political division arises.
To know what's really happening, subscribe to the Irish Examiner today at irishexaminer.com/subscribe.
Two incidents just want to touch on that actually effectively led up to the beginning of the Civil War, the conflict. One, and not too long ago I interviewed Ronan McCreevy, who's written the book about the assassination of Sir Henry.
As it happened, I chaired the session with him this morning.
Very good. Is there evidence there that Collins ordered that?
Well, that's...
I should just to remind listeners, Sir Henry Wilson, highly controversial figure, he'd been chief of the British Armed Forces, very close to what was evolving into the Unionist government in the north. Some, either fairly or unfairly, blamed him for some of the pogroms that were being carried out against Catholics in the north. He was effectively a hate figure to a large extent down here. And then he was shot dead in June 1922. The British initially blamed the garrison of anti-treaty people who were in the forecourts Ironically, though, there's a lot, has been for the last 100 years, a lot of speculation that it was Collins who ordered.
Well, I think Roland's answer this morning was read my book. But both parts of what you said are correct in the sense that the British immediately looked to this, as it were, as an excuse to put pressure on Collins specifically and the provisional government more generally to do something about the Four Courts garrison and specifically to get them out by hook or by crook. But also I think that ultimately it is the original order, which of course went back some time, did emanate from Collins. Now, one should remember, of course, that other figures within the Republican movement, people like Cottle Brewer, had come up with the idea of assassinating the entire British cabinet. And there had been assassination attempts previously, for example, on Lord French in late 1919. So the idea of targeting significant political figures and trying to get rid of them wasn't invented in the summer of 1922. And again, it's how you could argue going back to the things like the Phoenix Park killings in the 1880s. And even further back, there is a pedigree there.
Yeah, and because I spoke to Ron about that and that issue came up about Collins might have issued given the initial order to do so, but that would have been at the height of when the war was on. And yet, bang, it actually happens.
And you have all sorts of intermediaries.
Yeah, and between the most sensitive time imaginable. He's been put under pressure by the British, and suddenly this happens. What are they going to say? But you have to move. Yeah. That brings us to...
I think the key point there was that the British said, if you don't get rid of the garrison, we will.
Yeah.
And that was the crucial point. I mean, I think Collins's entire strategy after the treaty is based, as it were, on tactical flexibility, but strategically he has two aims in mind. Strategically, A, he believes that you have to get the British army out. There is the absolute bedrock position. Anything that contributes them to getting them out quickly is good and he'll back. Anything that contributes to them either slowing down or staying is a bad thing. And that's one of the reasons why he was opposed to the Four Courts garrison. I mean, the Four Courts garrison don't do very much when they take over. But what they do is give the British an excuse to hasten slowly on their pullouts. Secondly, he, in terms of his strategic concerns, he's building up the National Army as quickly as he possibly can. I don't think he's looking for civil war, but he clearly knows that this is a possibility. So everything that can hasten the British Army withdrawal and speed up the formation of the National Army, he's trying to do both at the same time. Politically speaking, he's also trying to deliver on his, as it were, stepping stone approach by trying to get as Republican a constitution as he possibly can.
He was head of the government at that stage.
Yeah, he's head of the provisional government. So a committee is established. Nominally, he's a member, but he isn't able to attend most of the meetings. But the directions that he gives towards the committee is, in effect, to make as Republican a constitution as possible that still is technically consistent with the treaty and Dominion status. And they come up with a clever approach. In effect, the treaty says you have to have the same constitutional status as Canada. But under Dominion status, Canada could draw up its own constitution.
Right.
So what Collins does is say he gives the British, in effect, what is de facto a Republican constitution. And the British say, well, this is nothing like the Canadian constitution. And Collins says, yes, but the Canadians could give themselves this constitution if they chose. So in effect, we have Canadian status. We're not going to mimic the Canadian constitution. We're going to use the freedom that you have given us in Dominion status, the freedom to draw up our own constitution and do it in any way that we like. The British basically said, good try, but no, we're going to insist that the provisions of the treaty are kept in there. But so that's the strategic, as it were, militarily, get the British out as quickly as possible and try and get up a formidable national army as quickly as possible. By the way, getting rid of the British, of course, would prevent the anti-treatyites attacking the British, which is something he knew that they were planning. And politically speaking, to try and get as Republican a constitution as possible, as quickly as possible, through the British, in effect, to deliver on the stepping stone approach. But beyond that, tactically, he would do anything to, in effect, meet those objectives. He would talk to anybody. He refused to shut down any avenue of opportunity, even where he didn't like it. For example, in dealing with the North, I mean, he had zero sympathy with the Belfast administration. Zero sympathy for the idea of partition, but he was willing to deal with James Craig, the Craig-Collins Pact in the early months of 1922, simply because this helped to demonstrate his bona fides with the British. Again, it gave him time, and perhaps also he was hoping that ultimately it might persuade the Unionists to vote in favour of staying within the Free State, which, because of course, that's what the treaty provided for.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
But simultaneously, he's also dealing with the anti-treaty eye and organising a campaign against the northern states. So it's this combination of tactical flexibility and at the same time, and making whatever decisions are needed on the spot. At the same time, he knows very definitely the directions he wants to go.
You wonder when he slept. It's
yes, absolutely, absolutely.
The one thing that really strikes me, Gabriel, quite obviously, he hadn't a clue that he was moving towards the end of his life, notwithstanding his suggestion 6 months previously when he signed the treaty. But 28th of June in the morning, and he orders the shelling of the forecourts. It has always struck me that, and you very eloquently showed all that was going on in so many different aspects of what he was trying to do with the country. But to do that against the people that, since the whole thing broke out, he had fought beside, it must have been for somebody like him a heart-wrenching moment.
Of course. I think it was a heart-rending moment for everybody on the pro-treaty side. They had done their best to try and avoid an outbreak of violence. And in fairness, many of those, even as it were, the militarists on the anti-treaty side, had avoided trying to start or even consider sort of a direct shooting match with their former allies. Their main concentration was, to the extent to which they were planning any sort of shooting, was against the British. The hope was that if you engaged, the anti-treaty hope was that if you somehow could draw the British out into a firefight, then that might be an opportunity to reunite the two sides in pursuit of the common enemy. But again, to come back to the point I made earlier, the British tell Collins, if you don't do this, we will. And I think Collins realised that if the British re-engaged the anti-treaty forces, it might not just slow down or stop the pullout, it might lead to the British redeploying troops across the country where they previously evacuated, such as Cork. So above everything else, Collins wanted to make sure that the British military got out. And if that meant that he had to do something that the British indicated they were willing to do themselves, then that... And I think he also made the call that at that point the National Army was sufficiently strong to be able to take on the fight, even though, of course, it was a close-run thing. I mean, so that many people still believe that the anti-treaty forces were stronger. And, of course, remember that the anti-treaty forces had scored a huge logistics success shortly before, a few weeks before, when they'd seized a huge cache of weapons from a British ship that was evacuating its weapons from Cork and the Upnor. And these weapons had been distributed amongst the Cork and Munster IRA. So the IRA, and again, this was one factor that Collins had to take into account, is that he's now dealing with an IRA that was better armed than it had been during the War of Independence, when they'd, of course, give the British a hard time. And he knew that Munster was always going to be the difficult nut to crack.
And despite that, similar to, and I suppose this is just a real indication of his character, after GPO, he realised there's a proper way to fight a war. He goes about it, and he goes about it in a strategic and a committed way. Once there's ceasefire, he addresses the treaty, he addresses it strategically, committed, and he decides, you know, he goes full on.
Yeah.
Once this broke out, he goes full on and he prosecutes the war as he feels he has to.
I think the idea was to try and win it as quickly as you possibly could.
And he did it. And effectively, in terms of any threat of the anti-treatyites taking over the country, he nearly had that done.
It was. And certainly the battle for Dublin is completed really within a week. And then you have, as it were, the conventional phase of the campaign where you have pretty large-scale forces being deployed, not quite in full-scale battle, but in, as it were, conventional military formations. You have a series of amphibious landings along the coast, which helps the government forces take important places because they didn't want to travel by land. So places like Tralee, Limerick, and, of course, here in Cork, there was a landing at Passage, and you had a three-day battle up the passage, Rochestown, Douglas Road. And it's in the context of that battle, of course, that Collins makes his fatal final visit to Cork.
Yeah. Was he still at that stage trying to send out feelers to some of the people on the other side?
I think so. But of course, remember that there were others on the anti-treaty side who recognised that the battle was, to all intents and purposes, already lost and would not have been, as it were, unamenable to that type of approach. But of course, you also have on both sides others who are saying on the pro-treaty side, we have them on the run, break them now. And if you call a halt now, then you're just leaving them with their weapons intact in situ when we're going to have to face a similar problem 6 months down the line, similar as it were to what Collins himself had argued over the treaty. And likewise, on the anti-treaty side, there are others who are saying, we cannot surrender, we will not surrender. It would be a betrayal of those who have died in the Civil War, as well as of all those who died during the War of Independence and the 1916 Rising. So I think Collins was amenable to a ceasefire. It didn't necessarily mean that he was going to sacrifice everything to get one. But he had been loath to see the fighting break out. He had been commander-in-chief. He had taken the final decision. But I think he thought that if you could deliver a sort of swift a victory as you possibly could, then everybody better, even the losers, would benefit from, as it were, a swift, decisive campaign, as opposed to the descent into Hades that ultimately took place over the winter of 22-23.
And as you said, he made that fateful final journey to Cork. He was down in Clonakilty. He's coming back through Béal na Bláth. Did the anti-treatyites who'd assembled there, did they know Collins was in that convoy?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I mean, there wasn't a doubt. I mean, there was no great secret about the fact that Collins had come to Cork. I mean, he was openly staying in the Imperial Hotel. And there was plenty of anti-treaty people still living in Cork. So the intelligence that he was operating in Cork and the fact that he departed from Cork that morning wasn't exactly a secret. The convoy had passed through Béal na Bláth earlier in the day. And that's one of the reasons, of course, why the ambush itself is set. The many of the other roads back to Cork had been trenched or with trees blown across them. So there weren't that many ways of getting back to Cork. The problem for those who set the ambush was that they couldn't sort of tell exactly what route he was coming from. And ultimately, when he does come back, they believe that he'd somehow given them the slip. So that the ambushers became the ambushed. They were in the process of dismantling the ambush and disconnecting the mine. So if anything, they were the ones who were in the vulnerable position. You're having an armed convoy, an armored car, the Slieve na Mann. You have a truck full of troops. And if anything, they're dealing with the people who were doing the original ambush, who are now out in the open or who had abandoned their prepared positions. So from that point of view, the ambush of Michael Collins is, as it were, an equal fight both ways. Both sides, I think, are trying to disengage to not lose face, but to make sure that they don't lose anybody in that ambush.
And there are some suggestions that a lot of them in Collins' party had taken a lot of drink by that time.
Well, I think that there's no question that they had been in the pub. Whether that meant that they were drunk and incapable of firing their weapons, I think I personally doubt. And certainly, from what I understand, from anybody who's been in combat, it doesn't matter how much drink that you've got.
As soon as the bullets start firing,
you sober up very, very quickly. Yeah. And the fact is that nobody else other than Collins is sort of suffers any serious
very
injury, which would suggest that they were perfectly capable of conducting themselves.
And did I see somewhere that when word came through, some of the anti-treatyites, I think including the likes of Tom Barry, were detained and they knelt down and said a prayer for
them? That's one testimony, but I've also heard seen other testimonies where there was cheering going on amongst Republican prisoners. So, they were opposing sides in the war. This was the head of the opposition. If De Valera had been killed during the Civil War, it's quite likely that his death would have been cheered by pro-government forces.
Two aspects then to his death and what you might call his immediate legacy. In terms of the character of the Civil War, it was in the autumn of that year that it got really vicious. Yes. The executions coming in, lots of reprisals and the whole thing. Two elements to it. One, Collins there no longer. He wasn't there to prosecute the war, so perhaps it took on a different character. Secondly, was there a lot of anger or fear on the pro-treaty side as a result of the killing of Collins that prompted them to turn a bit more vicious?
Well, yes, in terms of the latter question, I think they were quite fearful of what the future would hold, given that their leader, as you mentioned earlier on, is head and shoulders above everybody else on their side. Certainly people like Cosgrave, who took over as head of the provisional government, really is a marginal figure, politically speaking, and doesn't have the kudos, and certainly doesn't have the IRB connections and many of the other connections that, of course, Collins had nurtured during his time in the struggle. So, yes, there is a fear that, however much the war may appear to have been won at that point, it hadn't been won. And there was a fear that the tide could turn back again. And I think that helps to explain, to answer that, I suppose, the first part of the question, I think that helps to explain why it was that certainly the pro-treaty side start to adopt things like military tribunals, death sentences and reprisals, because they felt that they had to show that they possessed the will to prosecute the war to the maximum possible extent, in a way that Collins, of course, clearly everyone who understood that Collins sort of had the will to conduct a war, but Cosgrave, who'd been basically in charge of local government during the Dole,
he had been in GPO in 1916.
He had, and he had been out, but he was mainly seen as somebody on the civilian side. Richard Mulcahy, of course, had extensive experience of the IRA campaign as the chief of staff, and he's making a number of decisions. But Mulcahy doesn't by any manner of means see eye to eye with everybody within the pro-treaty government, and neither do they necessarily all.
Would he have been considered closer to Collins?
He would have been considered, and he would have been considered to be somebody who is a militarist who wouldn't necessarily accept the subordination of the army to civil control, which is what people like Kevin O'Higgins and Cosgrave themselves wanted. And ultimately, of course, years later, during the army mutiny, there is a falling out, and Mulcahy is one of the casualties of that. So there's a tendency to, as it were, look at both sides and regard them as almost homogenous and agreed on what they were fighting for and on the same page temperamentally and everything. But certainly on both sides, it's pretty widely known that De Valera didn't by any manner of means see eye to eye with the leaders of the anti-treaty campaign, and they didn't all by any manner of means have tremendous respect for him. But on the pro-treaty side as well, even within that upper echelon, that small upper echelon, there were very, very significant tensions. They didn't really manifest themselves at this point, but later on during the army mutiny, they did.
The other thing then is, as we know, the provisional government, it evolved into the first government until 1932, led by W.T. Cosgrave. That, even though it was Cumann na Gael, that evolved into Fine Gael, which had much the same character, I'd say, as Cumann na Gael, and De Valera, quite obviously the opposite in Fianna Fáil. It's all speculation once he's dead, but what we know of Collins, it wouldn't suggest to me that he would have been what you might call a typical member of what evolved into Cumann na Gael and Fine Gael.
True, true. Albeit, of course, remember that that itself had a composite character.
Yeah.
It was very heavily influenced by, as it were, sort of middle class elements and, as it were, property elements.
Exactly. Yeah.
But you also had a sort of a significant residue from the pro treaty side, who from lower down the social class. It's impossible to know. I mean, one thing that one should remember is that Collins had indicated by his agreeing to the pact election that he was open to contact with the other side, politically speaking. So it's impossible to... I mean, there are theses that what Collins might have done is to become some sort of generalissimo character, that he would, had he lived and had he been victorious in the Civil War, he could have emerged into a type of militarist that was common throughout Europe, not just people like...
A Franco, like.
Not just people like Franco or even Mussolini, but... the one that I think perhaps is interesting is Pilsudski in Poland. Poland had got its independence as a result of a campaign and also diplomatic support. Pilsudski was clearly the leading figure in that campaign. He had taken some part in the politics of post-independence Poland, but then retires. But then he sees it going in the wrong direction and in effect launches a military coup. But he never becomes military dictator. In effect, he sort of takes a back seat and lets it be known, however, that if things go wrong again, he might be willing to step in. Now, that's a possibility that Collins, without going down the fascist route or even the communist route, of course, might have had such kudos in terms of had he lived, that he may have been tempted to go into that role, given that he had this... 2 feet, such one foot in the military and 1 foot in the...
It would strike me that such a scenario wouldn't have been healthy in terms of democracy.
Probably, almost certainly not, no. But in times of trouble, of course, the plea always goes out for somebody strong to save the situation.
And it's possible that
could have developed.
And as somebody else pointed out to me, from that time, kind of small countries that did get independence involved, Ireland was the only one that ultimately did maintain its democracy.
Exactly, and I suppose that Ireland was lucky in the sense that with relatively small-scale problems, such as the Blue Shirt period in the early 1930s, it doesn't face the type of either domestic ideological problems or the external threats that countries in Central and Eastern Europe do.
So that's Collins, that's him. As we said, there books have been speculated on how he may have shaped the country.
Yeah.
Personally, apart from that, the scenario, the generalismo scenario is interesting. Apart from that, I would find it difficult to think how it could have been much of a different country. All of those people were all drawn from the same...
I mean, ideologically speaking, they were, to a large extent, cut from the same cloth. I mean, what once James Connolly, who's the absolute clear leader of not just the left wing of Irish politics, but sort of the Marxist left wing. What is left of the Labour movement is much more of a sort of reformist, incrementalist character.
But even on that, Gabriel, just briefly, that James Connolly, what always struck me about him, a great man, great admiration for him, would he ever have got elected in the Ireland that was there with the church and everything?
Well, I mean, he possibly could. I mean, again, we're trying to speculate whether he would have just been a little bit like, I suppose, sort of people for profit and solidarity in the current
world,
as it were, speaking from the margins. We just don't know.
No, of course. Yeah.
I mean, in one sense, the best contribution that Connolly makes to the left wing is to get himself killed in 1916, because he's then the martyr, and he sets the standard for everybody who's to come. And to a large extent, as we know, that everybody who's come subsequently in left-wing politics in Ireland has really always operated under his shadow.
Finally, and people have speculated as well, and I think that there's some comments made, Eamon de Valera and his own accommodation with how he behaved in there. He was recorded making comments about regrets and about Collins, and there were suggestions that his wife was particularly close to Collins, not in any...
romantic sense. No, I mean, what's really interesting about De Valera's attempt to police his historical reputation, and of course he does have an authorised biography published, is that he's infinitely more concerned about the relatively short period that he's out of power, which is precisely the period in the immediate aftermath of the ratification of the treaty and thereafter, than he is with his reputation for the very long period that he's in power after 1932, or even prior to the treaty vote between 1919 to 1921, which to me indicates that he was aware that some of the things that he said, obviously the famous notorious speech about wading through through the blood of a fellow Irishman, that was really a blot on his record. And of course, the idea that he sold out the Republic in advocating external association, when it came to that part of his reputation, certainly in terms of his official biography, he was exceptionally keen to get his version of events down. And of course, to a certain extent, Dorothy McArdle, in writing The Irish Republic in 1930, the mid-1930s, 36, 37, had already put down, as it were, on record, the De Valera version of those events.
Yeah, and no more than you said about James Connolly in terms of getting himself killed. It's difficult to escape that in terms of Michael Collins and his legacy, had he lived like all of us, he'd have been tarnished in some
of
way.
Course.
Couldn't he? And therefore, we view him in a particular light.
Now, of course, from if those who take an anti-treaty stance to the present day, his legacy was compromised. But I think certainly here in Cork, even those who would take a Republican point of view and sort of would argue historically that they would be sympathetic with anti-treaty, I think so great was his contribution to the independent struggle that there's a willingness to, as it were, overlook or at least diminish the sense of wrongdoing, as it were, in signing and standing over the treaty.
As a student of Collins, the Neil Jordan movie 1995, did that bring him to a new generation? Now, there's a lot, yes. There's been various criticisms in terms of historical accuracy, but you have to make allowances for
Hollywood. If you have a look at that period, there aren't that many feature films that have been made about that period. There's interestingly, there was one made in the 1930s, I think it's Beloved Enemy, which is available on, it's either Netflix or one of the streaming channels. And I took the opportunity to have a look at it. And there's one character there, which is Reardon, but which is clearly based on Michael Collins. It's actually not a million miles away from, as it were, the real Collins. It's probably as close to the real Collins as the Liam Neeson depiction in the Neil Jordan film. So I suppose in that sense, you can say one of the ultimate tributes to Collins' legacy is that in a revolutionary struggle that hasn't generated that many films, he's been depicted twice and has had his own biopic. I thought that the film, when it was first released, was superb, and I still think it's very strong. I personally think that when the film The Wind That Shakes the Barley came out, that really sort of is head and shoulders above any other depiction of the period as a whole. And very wisely, it avoided 99% in naming names or using real historical figures, even though, of course, Collins and
it also inserted a certain kind of socialist ideology that you'd wonder whether that was.
And that was probably a little overstated, as Ken Loach, I think, would admit.
Yeah.
Because I think he and Donald, my colleague here, Donald O'Driscoll, were very keen to emphasise that theirs was a version, a story the Irish Revolution rather than the story of the Irish Revolution.
Finally, as you said, number of biographies. Tim Pat Coogan's obviously one that stands out. Frank O'Connor's book, I have to say, I enjoyed.
Yeah, I mean, Frank O'Connor, again, ideologically speaking, in terms of the treaty, Frank O'Connor was as a superb writer. I mean, he really was. I mean, he was a great penman, and he knew how to depict. I don't think he necessarily knew Collins himself. I mean, Frank O'Connor, he was very much one of the rank and file in the local struggle. But if you're looking for tributes to Collins' memory, somebody who takes the anti-treaty side, 10 years later, writes a thoroughgoing and very admiring biography. I think that there's also, even at that point, there was an attempt made to try and depict Collins as almost the opposite, the polar opposite of De Valera. That book is written after De Valera's been in power for several years, and he's disappointing those who hope that Fianna Fáil would be as radical in government as it seemed to promise in opposition. And he wasn't the only one. Seán Ó Fualaon had written a very glowing biography of De Valera before Fianna Fáil going to power, and he produces a biography about the same time as O'Connor's one of Collins, and that's a very, very different take on De Valera. So,
It is. It's fascinating, and it'll continue to fascinate, I've no doubt, for another 100 years.
I think so.
Gabriel, thank you very much for talking to us today.
No problem.
I'd also like to thank our engineer, JJ Vernon. Thank you, folks, for listening, and we'll talk again soon.
Today's podcast is in partnership with Cork County Council.